This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Here, listeners to the podcast Suspect Convictions pose questions to the man convicted of murdering his daughter, including the question of how Barton McNeil's attorneys performed their duties.
My relations with my public defender were not good. Every time we went to a pretrial hearing, he seemed to be, like, completely clueless.
It's an episode called Ask Bart in our continuing presentation of the podcast Suspect Convictions. Hear from a Bloomington Normal native and U-High grad who worked as a visual effects coordinator on the new Star Wars film. And get a preview of this weekend's Illinois Symphony Orchestra performance. Charlie Schlenker talks with ISO music director Ken Lamb. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's December 15th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. From his prison in Southern Illinois, convicted murderer Barton McNeil speaks. That's today's episode of the podcast Suspect Convictions with journalist Scott Reeder and Willis Kern.
The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911,
what's your emergency? I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying. I think rescue is needed. 3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
Christina,
it's Christina.
He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions, a co-production of WGLT Radio and Reader Reporting. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. Today, it's an episode many have been looking forward to. It's your chance to ask a question of Barton McNeil in a segment that we're calling Ask Bart. Scott, some people might be wondering, why are we having an episode where Bart is addressing listeners firsthand?
As a journalist, I like immediacy. I like to have as intimate a relationship between the listeners or the audience and the folks that we're reporting on as possible. And I got to thinking, you know, I haven't heard any podcasts where they've allowed the listeners to ask questions directly of the defendant in the case. And I thought, you know, this is something we really ought to give a try to and see how it works. I mean, I think Bart is so eager to share his thoughts and respond to the questions and do these things. I mean, I talk to Bart. He calls me probably a couple times a week, and we talk about whatever I'm working on, and he was game for answering questions. And I got to add that this is really unusual. Usually, attorneys will tell their clients, be quiet, don't talk to anybody, don't answer questions, just stay quiet and let us be your spokesperson. But this is very different. I mean, Bart is being very open and willing to answer the questions, and I think it could be very interesting, the kind of responses we're getting to get from him.
What kind of response, Scott, did we get to our request for questions for Bart from among our listeners?
It was absolutely awesome, Willis. I mean, we had folks from Australia and all over the world responding. And I'm sorry to say, I mean, because we only had about an hour on the phone with Bart. We're not going to be able to ask every question that was sent to us, but we're asking a bunch of the questions, and some of the questions that were asked were things that I had never even thought to ask him as a reporter, so I'm excited about hearing what his responses are.
And we'll hear from some of our listeners, our audience, firsthand to Bart. It's okay, Scott, let's get to our first question then for Bart.
We have Elisa Greenberg from Philadelphia.
And my question is, I was wondering if Ms. Sook would have been able to just peer into the window of the computer room that you were sitting in during the night of the murder, because from what it sounded like, she would have to climb up onto something to look into the room. And I was wondering if that would make noise or a disturbance, and if anybody else or yourself would have been able to hear her.
I was in the front of the apartment in the living room. There are two easily seen from the crime scene photographs. If the caller would like to go to the website and look, I believe all the photographs are there. You've probably seen them too. The sill is probably 4 feet off the ground, so the foot would not have needed to step on anything other than step through some foliage, some bushes, and these tall weeds below the window, which incidentally were trampled the next morning. But she wouldn't have needed to have stood on anything to have peered through the little gap between the Venetian blinds and the window molding to have seen me plain as day sitting there by the computer. And I'm sure she would have done so, even if she hadn't. She could have seen that the light was on. She knew that I spent a lot of time at the computer. She probably could see the movement of me through the Venetian blinds, even if she hadn't, you know, actually gone right up there and peered in the window. So, no, she could easily look through the window without making any noise at all and seen me fairly easily and known what I was doing and exactly where I was.
All right. Thank you very much, Bart. And Scott, what's our next question about?
It's coming from a woman named Diane. She has several questions here. I'll read them out here. I want to know what Bart thought at the time before his conviction about his chances for a fair trial in McLean County. Did he feel his judge was going to be impartial? Did he feel his public defender was going to do a good job? How was he treated by the McLean County court system? Was he treated impartially by the jail? Was he kept in jail and isolated from the other inmates? Does he feel his public defender met with him sufficiently and was on top of his case? Did his public defender listen to him, and was he open to his input? What did the public defender tell him his reasons were for wanting a bench trial rather than a jury trial? Did Barton feel in control of his decision-making?
All right, let's find out Bart's response.
No, not at all. I don't think I was treated fairly. I was horribly railroaded, but the jailhouse staff treated me as expected. Decently enough, I was in semi-isolation in protective custody only because I had a child murder and was facing, you know, a pretty serious case. I was in a pod with six other guys that were in protective custody. So I was more or less isolated from the majority of the jail population for my safety, I guess. The public defender, I was assigned two of them. Interestingly, one of them had been my divorce attorney, and she had personally got into it with Ms. Sook over my divorce one time. So when she was appointed to my case, it was kind of interesting that she knew of her temperament anyway. My relations with my public defenders were not good. Every time we went to a pretrial hearing, he seemed to be like completely clueless of the basic facts and circumstances that were really important to whatever the hearing was on that particular day. And while the prosecutors just steamrolled over him, during which he could have easily refuted almost everything they had said based on the investigative paperwork that I was shuffling and laying right in front of him as they spoke, he just sit there silently and essentially defer to everything the prosecutor said. So, I mean, after this had happened, I don't know, five or six times, you know, not only was I questioning his competence, but I was questioning his possibly hidden agenda. I had thought the judge was fairly impartial, but he seemed to be bowled over at every pretrial hearing by the prosecutor's baseless claims and essentially ruled in their favor, you know, on every motion hearing. And all I could do is just sit there and shake my head like, hey, I didn't do this. Somebody, you know, stop the steamroller, please.
All right. Very good. Thank you. And Scott, our next question.
It comes from Tammy in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Bart, I wanted to ask you about when was your last contact with Ms. Sook before Christina's death? And what was the nature of that contact?
This was the final argument and breakup between Ms. Sook and myself, the showdown that we had at this restaurant just a few hours before Christina's murder. Anyway, I finally agreed to meet her at this restaurant, this Italian restaurant, Bavanti's. I decided I wasn't going to pick up Christina until later on, so I didn't want Christina being present during what I was sure was going to be a fight. So I met her about 6 o'clock at this Italian restaurant, and within 10 minutes, we were arguing pretty bitterly over, mainly over her own revelations of the extent to which she had been stalking me and stalking my phone records through her employer and picking up my garbage off the curb to go through to find out what I'd been doing. But anyway, this was the last time I personally saw Masuk. She, after our fight ended, she went to my car and she wouldn't get out of my car. And I'm like, I'm threatening to call the police and everything. So finally she gets out of my car. She follows me to Christina's mother's house. I pulled over and I got out of the car. I said, Masuk, what the hell are you doing following me? Get lost, bug out, don't follow me. I'm going to pick up Christina, and that's it. And that was the last time that I personally saw her prior to Christina's murder.
Our next questions are coming from Aphrodite Jones. She was a guest, as you folks will remember, on an earlier podcast. She is a world-renowned true crime writer. She's authored several books, has her own television show on the IG channel, and looks at a variety of different cases.
Why wouldn't he immediately jump to the conclusion when he's saying it's a murder on the phone to the police that it was this woman, that it was Masuk? I just find there's a lapse there, a gap there that doesn't make sense.
Why I didn't think that this didn't occur to me, I had no reason to suspect an intrusion had happened up until then. I saw no obvious signs of trauma or, you know, stab wounds or anything like that. I assumed it was a sudden natural cause of illness or something. That's why I didn't jump to the conclusion, you know, without having seen the evidence, you know, meaningful evidence. That it was the farthest thing from my mind, quite frankly.
Why is he allowing her to be anywhere near his three-year-old?
Because 90% of the time, she was rather ordinary. She had issues here and there, but she hadn't really overtly struck me or anything like that. Her problems were more psychological. So I never felt until the very end that she posed a physical danger.
Why did it take time for him to come up with this idea that he was going to get a confession out of Masuk that she molested his daughter and probably used one of her vibrators on Christina? That is just so off the charts weird.
That's a fair question, and the answer is pretty easy. The police implied or said or inferred from their questioning that some evidence existed that Christina's death had been accompanied by some sort of sexual abuse. Okay, well, sexual abuse and rape and whatnot is usually committed with male anatomy. And since Masuk herself does not have male anatomy, I reasoned that whatever it was that had violated her had was a foreign object. And since I knew Masuk had foreign objects that basically were a substitute for male anatomy, I mean, I guess he could have used her hand or something, but since the police eventually, finally, did go to her apartment and take these into custody and send them off to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab, they must have thought that my suspicions were warranted enough to do that themselves.
All right, very good. Thank you very much. That's Barton McNeil speaking to us from the Menard Correctional Center in Southern Illinois. This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. We're doing a segment today called Ask Bart. And Scott, what is our next question?
His name is Bob Ruff. He is a former arson investigator from Michigan who hosts the true crime podcast Truth and Justice.
I would like to know, did he know the exact injuries, exactly what was found? Because he certainly was able to describe his theory of exactly how that would have happened in a way that doesn't fit with the injuries. Now, if they had told him, these were the injuries, like this is what we think, then sure, in your mind, you come up with a hypothesis what could fit that. But if all they told him was there's signs of sexual assault, and then he comes out and describes something that someone else could have done that would have caused those exact same injuries, that would be another big red flag.
When I had mentioned the stuff, you know, later on, this was after, toward the end of these several interviews of me, by then, the police had made it clear to me that they thought that Christina had suffered from sexual abuse. Otherwise, I'd have never mentioned the vibrators. I mean, the only reason I mentioned them is because the police had told me and implied through the nature of their questions that this had occurred. So
again, this is a perfectly reasonable thing for me to say in response to their allegation that Christina had suffered from some sort of molestation or sex abuse during the course of her murder.
What caused him to all of a sudden make that leap that he believes that there was a murder and foul play? I would like to know the answer to that question.
I leaped to nothing. This is completely untrue, and it's based on some erroneous premises. My suspicions that Christina had been murdered developed much later on, probably not until 5 or 6 hours after Christina's death. The stuff was behind the bedroom window break-in resulting in Christina's death. Clearly, McCook had murdered my daughter. I don't know what other conclusions I could possibly have drawn from this evidence personally known to me that I'd witnessed myself. And this question sort of conflicts with the Aphrodite Jones question that had asked quite the opposite. What took you so long? So, I mean, you can't have it both ways. But, you know, again, this is no leap. It was 10 hours before I called the police back to the scene after I had seen the evidence. And my first mention of Christina having been murdered didn't occur until I had returned to the scene and personally examined the condition of the window, which was not in that condition yesterday. I know that for an absolute fact.
Hey, thanks, Bart. I really appreciate you answering that question for us. Our next question is coming from Charlie Worrell, a podcaster in Kansas City. She's also the mother of six and co-host of the podcast Insight.
Why did he think he didn't hear it? And I also wondered, did he leave the home at any point that evening? Did he go outside? Did he go to his car to get something? Is there any explanation for why he was one room over and didn't hear it?
I did not leave the home at any time that evening, and I would not have left Christina alone in my apartment for any reason at all at that age. Never did. Didn't do it that night either. Aware of my presence in the living room, I'm sure. The bedroom window intruder would have been especially quiet in order to get away with the deed. Okay. Surely not alone. In my opinion, another set of hands would have made the intrusion not only easier, but a lot quieter, too. I didn't hear anything suspicious. It was warm that evening. There was an oscillating table fan nearby, on high, all evening long. I was listening to music on the stereo next to the computer desk, not blaring, but the music was playing. Whatever effect that may have tempered my ability to hear strange noises, I was sitting at the computer desk near a wide-open living room windows, and any noises I may have heard might have been coming from outdoors. What few noises were heard were unaware of their origin and were not sounding suspicious. I don't recall having heard anything particularly, suspicious that you wouldn't ordinarily hear in an apartment building, neighboring, tenants, bumps and whatnot. The only unusual noise or sound I heard the entire course of the night was Christina's own voice. So it's not that I didn't hear anything. I didn't hear any, breaking glass or a break-in occurring. But the sound of Christina's voice I did hear, only because I happened to be passing by the bedroom on the way to the bathroom at about 12:30 a.m., during which, when I opened the door, Christina was excited, trying, I believe, to convey to me another person's presence in her bedroom, someone she knew, which at the time was such an unlikely circumstance that I considered flatly impossible. But I was otherwise unable to figure out why Christine was acting strangely. And let me just end this question by saying, if you had a child Christina's age and she were awake at 12:30 at night and explicitly said, Daddy, my best friend Julie, who lives 15 miles away, is in my closet. Would you go look in the closet or just dismiss this as, well, that's not even possible? Unfortunately, that's exactly what I did. And I bear some responsibility for Christina's death, for not having turned on the light and followed her gaze into the darkened corner or looked around trying to discern what she was talking about. But I'm convinced that she was trying to alert me to the presence of somebody else who she named in Christina's bedroom that night at about 12:30. And I'm convinced that, yes, the intruder was already present, either immediately outside the bedroom window or had already entered the bedroom, and that Christina was actually talking to her soon-to-be killer, unaware of the danger that this person posed to Christina's life.
Well, thanks, Bart. That was helpful. Our next question is from Rabia Chowdhury, a world-renowned podcaster and attorney. In fact, she really is the mother of Serial. She was the person who came forward and got Sarah Koenig to do the podcast Serial about her family friend, Anand Saeed. And then she went on to host her own podcast, Undisclosed, which looks at a variety of cases of potential actual innocence all across the United States. And she's also an attorney who specializes in immigration law.
At some point after he put her to bed, he did hear her talking, and he checked in on her. And it seemed like she was talking to herself and smiling. And then he said, go back to sleep type of thing, and left. And that was, and then he didn't check in on her until the next morning. My question would be, like, was that unusual behavior for her? Was that something she did normally? Or was that, like, an indication that maybe somebody else was in the room with her?
Yes, it was very unusual. Highly, highly unusual. Typically, when I put Christina to bed late at night, or whenever I put her to bed, geez, when did I put her to bed? Man, it's been so long. I think I put her to bed at about, it was about 10:30 or 11, that's right. And typically, she'll sleep through the entire night. She doesn't wake up in the middle of the night. She doesn't wake up and cry. She doesn't wake up and go to the bathroom, usually. She usually sleeps through the entire night. I knew she was pretty tired when I put her to bed. And she would have been asleep within 5 minutes of me having put her to bed. So, yes, it was very unusual for her to be awakened by whatever it was. I thought that she, and I had told this to the police the next day, not realizing the implications of Christina's awakening in relation to Christina's murder, which I assumed to have occurred much later on that night. And I just thought, well, Christina must have just awakened from this vivid dream or something. And it wasn't just that she was awake, she was talking, seemingly in a conversational manner when I had opened the door, when I had passed by the door. And then she was sitting straight up, she was smiling, and her gaze was sort of transfixed behind me somewhere, it seemed like. And it was very, very unusual, yes. But attributing suspicious character to this, and Christina herself is not the least bit afraid of anything, by whatever it was that had excited her. She was very pleased with herself. And in fact, one of your guests, it was either Charlie or Rabia, said the other day that her own daughter would have played this little game too, to don't tell Daddy, but we're playing this game, just be quiet. It seemed like that's exactly what Christina was doing. She had this little insider joke that was I wasn't quite in on, and she was just smiling from ear to ear about it. But here again, I did not read into this anything like, oh, there's an intruder present.
This question comes from Donna. She has several questions, actually. First one is, did Masuk ever have access to a key to your home?
Yes, she did. And I don't know how she did this. She's an expert on this kind of stuff. I had moved out from the apartment I had shared with her 2 months earlier, and I had been very careful about not letting her have access to this key. I wouldn't even keep it on my key ring. Every time they visited her or that she had come to my apartment, I always made a special effort to keep this key someplace where she couldn't find it, where I thought I was careful. I wasn't careful enough because about a week prior to Christina's murder, Masuk showed up in my apartment. Well, maybe it was two or three weeks, a week or two, and I had a female guest. Masuk would have just gone ape shit. She knew that I had a female guest. So I pretended not to be home, and I locked the door before she had gotten to the door. I had seen her pull up through the windows, and she's banging and banging on the door. As a matter of fact, the neighbors had seen her and reported this to the police a day or two after Christina's murder, the sightings of Masuk pounding on the front door and yelling through the door. Masook had gone around to the side, to the bedroom window, too, and hollered through the bedroom window, "Bart, I know you're in there, let me in, blah, blah, blah." Anyway, she goes back to the door, and I'm standing right in front of the door, and I see the door lock, the little latch, and I'm like, "Oh, my God, she's got a key to my apartment." So before she could push the door open, I went up against the door and held it there with all my weight. She didn't get past the door, but I'm like, "How in the hell did she get a copy of the key to my apartment?" She did have a key to my apartment. I don't know how she got it, but it's certainly within her character and means to do this kind of stuff. She's a pro.
Were you ever asleep that evening, or were you awake or on the computer with headphones the whole time?
I was not on the computer with headphones. Music was playing through the stereo. Not particularly loud, but it was playing. No, I was not wearing headphones or earbuds or anything like that. After we returned from McDonald's, I picked up a Happy Meal for her. And while she ate her Happy Meal, I laid down on the couch. This was probably 8:30 or so, and I napped until approximately 10 o'clock. Well, Christina bounded about, we're quietly played, and when I woke up, Christina was sitting at the foot of the sofa where I was laying, and she had a couple of her books strewn around the floor and a couple of toys. She had gone into the bedroom and gathered her toys and had gone out and been quietly playing at the foot of my bed. I think I put in a Disney movie, too, before I'm sure I did. The Little Mermaid.
All right, very interesting, Bart. Thank you. And Scott, the next question?
Is from Wesley. In the years since you were convicted, has anyone still been in contact with Masook?
No, not at all. I've often wondered many times, what is she doing? Is she married now? Does she have any kids? Who else has she gotten away with killing? It sounds like a joke, but it's not. I'm certain. Christina's murder was not going to be the last that she committed. In fact, I explicitly said so during court hearing. You can read the transcripts, dears. Ever since I arrived in prison, I have had no contact with anybody that knew her. I had no idea what she's been doing all those years until I received the article of Masook's arrest for killing her mother-in-law.
What is your relationship with your daughter's mother? Do you continue to have contact with her after you were arrested or convicted?
No, I did not. I attempted to many times. I think the last, even recently, I think the last letter I sent her was probably a year or a couple, 2 years ago when I invited her to attend this DNA hearing in a court hearing a couple of years ago. And this would be like at least probably the 15th or 20th letter that I sent her over the years, beginning with my arrest, and she never responded to any of them. The police and the state's attorney's office had managed to put a call block on her phone immediately after my arrest to prevent me from speaking to her. And they went to extraordinary means. They were intercepting my mail to Christina's mother to prevent her from hearing anything that I had to say. So this is another just horrible tragedy that she deceived to this extent into believing that the man that she once loved, the father of her child, was responsible for their own child's murder. This is just another tragic, consequence of this. I guess we have to honor, her wishes, because she has suffered no worse than I have over the death of her daughters.
Seeing as Mamart is one of the most dangerous prisons in the state, have you tried to be transferred to a medium security prison?
No, I have not. Whether you want to move or not, that's not up to you. You have to meet a number of criteria that are pretty strict. They seem to be loosening the criteria now because of overcrowding and other things. But generally speaking, you don't get transferred to a lesser security prison until you've served 20 years. I'm now in my 19th year.
All right, that does it for our episode, Ask Bart, a chance for listeners to actually interact with Barton McNeil from Menard Prison.
What did you think was the most interesting thing he had to say, Willis?
We actually uncovered a bit of contradictory information here because you had said before that you had heard from somewhere that he was wearing headphones during the time that most of this activity was taking place late in the night at his house, but apparently that wasn't the case.
You know, I've been racking my brain as to where that came from. I have to go back to my notes to look. But I'm glad he clarified that. I mean, and I thought it was interesting, too, because, you know, that's something that doesn't necessarily help his case when, I wasn't on headphones. I had the stereo going, but I did not have headphones on. But doesn't that raise some other questions for you, Willis?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it conceivably, unless we have to do a double check here and revisit the original trial that occurred, maybe the headphones was not an issue in the trial and never came up from either prosecution or defense. If it did, then yeah, it's a game changer, I think. If it didn't, then we just have to set the record straight.
Yeah. You know, here's a question for you. Do you reckon that the attorneys on both sides are going to be listening carefully to Bart's answers on this episode?
I would think so. I would think the attorneys would be listening carefully to anything he says, because it's not often you get to address a prisoner who's been convicted of a crime much on the record, much less just in a one-to-one setting. So I'm sure that anything he says, which is obviously on the record, he's saying it on a podcast, is going to be something they're going to bookmark in their minds about how it factors into his potential retrial.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, because we don't want people to think we're oriented towards the prosecution or towards the defense. We're going to give the same opportunity to the McLean County State's Attorney, to his office, to answer questions from listeners. We'll let you know if they agree to do such an episode or not in the future, but we're going to reach out to them this week and see if they have some interest in fielding questions from our listeners.
And we thank all of our listeners for writing in and asking questions in the Ask Bart segment. And we also would like to thank those who actually called in and asked their questions to Bart, and of course to our expert panelists that we had on asking questions as well. Next week, Scott, we're going to be considering DNA evidence in this case.
DNA is something that people think can always be definitive. Sometimes it can be kind of ambiguous, and we're going to talk a little bit about that.
All right, that's coming up next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week during Suspect Convictions.
Hear new episodes each Friday on GLT's Sound Ideas and at WGLT.org/suspectconvictions. You can also subscribe to Suspect Convictions on your favorite podcast app. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the Chicago Festival Ballet Dancing the Nutcracker in a fresh performance of the holiday classic to add enchantment to the season on Thursday, December 28th. Tickets and information at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The latest episode in the Star Wars saga opens this weekend. The Last Jedi is garnering rave reviews. Normal native Lane Howard saw it months ago. That's because he worked on the film. He's a visual effects coordinator at Industrial Light and Magic, the iconic visual effects company that was built on Star Wars. Howard went to University High School and majored in anthropology at ISU, where his parents worked. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with him this week about his path to a galaxy far, far away.
It was quite a circuitous route. I blame Steven Spielberg and George Lucas for most of it. I focused on archaeology at ISU, and I attended an archaeological field school in New Mexico. So I met my wife, who's a Canadian, and I eventually ended up moving to Vancouver. So once I was in Vancouver, I had the few choices to make, and my thoughts were to either return to grad school and continue in archaeology, or given there was an actual viable film industry in Vancouver, pursue a dream that I had as a teenager to work in the film and animation industry. So At that point, my wife sold her truck and to help me pay for film school, and off I went to learn about visual effects and animation.
What were your favorite kind of movies growing up?
Well, I certainly grew up on a steady diet of movies and art and comics and animation as a kid, and thanks in large part to my father's shared interest. And it was certainly a life-changing moment for me seeing Star Wars for the first time. And at a drive-in theater and a double feature with my parents, of all places. In terms of the films that interested me, I certainly sci-fi, fantasy were the top of my list. I had a love for Westerns and still do. So movies like Blade Runner were huge for me. And of course, Jurassic Park, Tim Burton's Batman, Back to the Future, Tron, you know, the list goes on. James Bond. So it was, I couldn't get enough of it.
Well, I, you know, like me, I'm sure you remember the visual effects from movies back in the 80s, the 90s, when you saw something like Back to the Future or even Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 90s, things changed with the Terminator franchise and what Terminator 2 did with James Cameron. I guess, what's it like for you to watch older movies like that now this is your career now, this is your passion, and you're actually working in visual effects?
Well, it's quite surreal, I have to say, for sure. I still go back to revisit the classics. I mean, it's a guilty pleasure for me. And some certainly hold up better than others. I think that, you know, some people and some colleagues might say that it spoils a little bit of the magic once you know how the secret sauce is made. But I don't think so. I think a good story stands the test of time, for sure. So I still go back, and I actually watched Jurassic Park a couple weeks ago on Netflix, and it still holds up for me.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm joined today by Lane Howard, a normal native who now works for Industrial Light and Magic, the visual effects company famously founded by George Lucas. Howard worked on the new Star Wars movie opening on Friday. So, Lane, what do you do at ILM, Industrial Light and Magic?
I'm a visual effects coordinator.
And what does that entail?
It's a lot of cat wrangling, so it's primarily, in a nutshell, it involves scheduling and managing teams of artists, reviewing work with visual effects supervisors and the director, and basically helping to ensure that the work delivers on time and shepherding the project along with a team of production.
What are some of the projects you've worked on since you've been at ILM?
Well, since I've been at ILM, actually, The Last Jedi was the first project that I worked on, so it was quite a shock to me. 4 days before I was supposed to start my role there, I had an email that I was being changed off of Jurassic World, actually, and moved on to Star Wars. So I was actually in normal at the time, and thought that it was bad news coming through. And then once I read the email, I realized that I was actually going to be on Star Wars as my first show at ILM, which was just an incredible opportunity and surprise.
Yeah, so. God, what a note to receive at your first job at ILM, which is just cool on its own, is to be working on The Last Jedi.
Star Wars was a film that I saw as a child with my parents, and it was hugely impactful for me. I mean, it really, in many ways, changed my perspective on movies and science fiction and what they could be at the time. So, you know, anything Star Wars related as a kid had to be acquired. So I was a big collector of the toys. I was a member of Bantha Tracks, which was the Star Wars fan club at the time, and I couldn't get enough of it. So it was a big moment for me to see that film and the sequels.
Your position now at ILM, this seems like a pretty significant career move for you, given that you were in film school not too long ago.
Yeah, it was certainly, you know, a roundabout way that I came to this. And when I went back to film school, I was trained as an artist and specifically as an animator. And after a little while, I made a decision to go into production, which I think in many ways allows me to have kind of a bigger picture view of the whole project, which interests me greatly. I worked for a couple of years prior to ILM at a studio called Zoic Studios in primarily TV and some small features. And in terms of my trajectory, I'm incredibly happy where I'm at. My plan is to carry on and continue working in my role and moving up in that role to hopefully, you know, help shepherd these projects along and have an impact on how they're made.
But what was director Rian Johnson like to work with on The Last Jedi? He's sort of emerged here as this caretaker of the Star Wars franchise moving forward.
Rian was an absolute pleasure to work with. It was, you know, we reviewed work with him multiple times during the week. He was an incredibly fun and gracious person throughout the whole process. And, I mean, his excitement for the work really brought out the kid in all of us. I think the franchise is in great hands, and I really look forward to seeing what Rian has to bring to the table for the franchise. It's a pretty exciting time.
You've worked on some sensitive projects, so The Last Jedi, the Jurassic World sequel. I got to ask, is it hard to keep your mouth shut when it comes to spoilers and friends, family asking you about kind of what you're working on?
No. In short, it's not. I mean, it's aside from being contractually obligated to keep my mouth shut, you know, I think most people don't want films spoiled for them. And when, you know, a friend would learn what I might be working on, you know, he quickly put his hands over his ears and said, "I don't want to know anything." I said, "Well, I can't tell you anything." So no, it's not hard at all.
What is your favorite part about working in the visual effects in the movie business?
Well, I would say certainly the people, and I would also add on to that the projects. You know, working with so many talented and dedicated people and helping play a role in the creative process is incredibly rewarding. You know, it's something that I think I knew deep down inside that I wanted to do as a kid, and to actually be in the room with some of these people, you know, and working towards the same goal to make these films is a highlight, and I consider myself very fortunate.
Lane Howard is a visual effects coordinator on the new Star Wars movie and a native of Normal. He spoke with GLT's Rian Denham, and in case you're wondering, Denham had to fight off Star Wars fangirl Laura Kennedy for dibs on interviewing someone who'd actually worked on Star Wars. Laura, however, will chat with GLT's culture maven Sherry Zeck next week about the film and its place in our culture. Hear that interview next week on GLT's Sound Ideas.
Hi, my name is Maddie, and I live in Louisville, Kentucky. I love Bullseye because the way that Jesse Thorne interviews everyone, it really seems like there are questions that they've never been asked before.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, Judd Apatow, the busiest man in Hollywood, plus the British stand-up comedian Ramesh Ranganathan. That's on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Join me tomorrow at 11 a.m. on GLT. News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The composer Astor Piazzolla was little known throughout most of his 92 years of life. But Illinois Symphony Orchestra music director Ken Lamb says that started to change in the Argentinian's latter years. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Lamb about Piazzolla's work Four Seasons in Buenos Aires and other works being performed tomorrow. Lamb says Piazzolla was one of the forward-looking musicians who did something of his own with the traditional form of the tango, and that spread.
And a lot of classical musicians, particularly Gidon Kremer, the Latvian violinist, he really really identified with this music and really took it to the classical audience. And with the work that we are going to play, the Four Seasons of Buenos Aires. And of course, when Piazzolla wrote this piece, it wasn't for the arrangement, the orchestral arrangement that we're going to do today, but it was for, you know, his sort of tango band. And Gidon Kremer, I think, had it done it became violin concerto with strings.
A lot of his work is done in chambers, chamber ensembles, and in quartets. The one that you tend to hear a lot of is his Oblivion.
Mm.
How is that different from the Four Seasons?
Well, the Four Seasons, as I'm sure everyone listening know, when you talk about the Four Seasons, you think almost instantly of Vivaldi. And I think Piazzolla's take was, well, you know, we have Four Seasons down in Argentina as well. And so he sort of took Vivaldi's Four Seasons and he took motifs from it. His own version is very, very much flavored by, you know, his tango and music that he knows well, but you will hear snippets of Vivaldi in it. Maybe sometimes it's just a rhythm, but it has been he uses the Vivaldi rhythm, but it has been, you know, harmonized and I guess tangoized. I don't know what the word is, but it's a great. I think also Where Oblivion is much more melodic and much more lyrical. The Four Seasons is very lively and also very rhythmically exciting. Pair the Four Seasons with Vivaldi. Usually people pair it with the Vivaldi Four Seasons, and you do, you know, spring in one hemisphere and you do the autumn in the other and so on. But I thought, well, you know, let's not do the Vivaldi Four Seasons, but do Vivaldi arias. And so we got one season and an aria and so on. So you still get Vivaldi, but it's a different kind. Vivaldi also wrote a lot of operas that most of us don't know about. You know, when you even opera houses, they don't do that many of Vivaldi's operas, you know. And some of the arias that Vivaldi wrote are stunningly beautiful and incredibly difficult. And also that gives me an excuse to bring in one of today's, I think, very fine countertenors. His name is Daniel Moody. His career has just gone crazy.
The countertenor voice is sufficiently different and sufficiently rare that maybe a lot of people in central Illinois have never heard one. Talk about the quality of the sound produced by a countertenor.
Well, of course, countertenor were the alto of the day in Baroque times, and because women were not allowed to perform. So the soprano voice, the highest voice of the choir, would be sung by trebles, so the boy sopranos, before their voice broke. And altos were male altos who sang, they are adults, but they sing in falsetto. So they sing with the head voice. And whereas a tenor or bass or a female alto would be singing a lot with the chest voice. And so it's a sort of very ethereal quality to it. A lot of people associate countertenor with a sort of, kind of like weak and sort of heady, sort of kind of, you know, sort of straight tone.
They'd be wrong.
They would be very wrong. I mean, this countertenor, you have operatic countertenor, which is what Daniel Moody is. And I did Handel Messiah with him and three other soloists last week. And he was by far the loudest. I mean, the soprano was in it, was not even close.
Ken Lamb is the music director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, which performs at Second Presbyterian Church tomorrow evening at 7:30. Lamb spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to The Four Seasons of Buenos Aires by Astor Piazzolla. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Ryan Denham, Willis Kern, Scott Reeder, and Charlie Schlenker. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas and the podcast Suspect Convictions. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org, or you can tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.